I mentioned in the first hour, Peter is talking about our salvation in this chapter. We looked at verses 10 through 12, kind of a parenthetical or an aside, where when he says in verse 10, as to this salvation, the prophets prophesied of things like this. I find it interesting that the way that Peter has decided to present our salvation to us is in a metaphor, a picture. And it's actually a picture that came from the Old Testament, something that I believe the first century Christians would have picked up on, understanding that the image that was being painted about their salvation was an Old Testament sort of metaphor. Well, what was it? Look at verse 3 of 1 Peter 1. When he says, "Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his great mercy has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead." That language, born again, it's synonymous with being saved, salvation. But this idea of being born again is something that I think for me personally, I looked at it very one-dimensionally growing up. In fact, if somebody would have asked me when I was younger, "Hey, what does it mean to be born again?" I would have said something like this. Well, being born again means you get to start over. You know, you died your old life, you raised to walk in newness of life, and you get to be born again. By the way, that's true, that's accurate. That's part of the Bible's teaching about being born again. But I want you to notice as we go through 1 Peter chapter 1 that he doesn't say things like that. That his focus on being born again is not, the good news is you get to start over, but there's all these other amazing benefits in being born again. And if God has caused that to happen in your life, then you've got more than just starting over. But that's the metaphor. Verse 3, being born again, that's the way that he's decided to present our salvation. Go to the end of the chapter, look at verse 23. He says it again at the end of the chapter, "For you have been born again, not of seed which is perishable, but imperishable, that is through the living and enduring word of God." Now notice, in verse 3 and in verse 23, we've been born again. The way this chapter will end, if you notice verse 24 through 25, is with a quote from the Old Testament. Peter will quote Isaiah chapter 40 in reference to this idea of being born again. That's his proof text, is this prophecy in Isaiah 40. And we're going to, at the end of the lesson, we're going to go there and kind of look at it. But just for a minute, I want you to look at how this is being framed up. In the middle of the chapter, in verse 10 through 12, he says, "The prophets prophesied of the grace that would come to you." And here in his presentation of us being born again, he uses Isaiah to sort of point us back to the idea of being born again. You know, again, when I was younger, I used to just think of being born again as like a New Testament concept, that Jesus came along and decided this would be a great sort of metaphor or picture, so he used that language. But do you remember Jesus having a conversation about being born again with a man who was a teacher of the law? In John chapter 3, do you remember the man's name that came to him at night? Nicodemus. And in that conversation, Jesus said, unless one is born again, he can't enter the kingdom. Unless one's born from above, some versions say, he can't enter the kingdom. Do you remember how Nicodemus reacted to that? He almost made some jokes about it. He's like, well, how can that be? How can a man can't go back into his mother's womb and be born again, can he? And in that conversation, Jesus rebuked him. In John chapter 3, around verse 10, he said, "Are you the teacher of Israel and you don't know these things?" Now, how could Jesus rebuke an Old Testament scholar for not understanding being born again, unless being born again was an Old Testament idea? So that's important. That the way the first century Christians would talk about their salvation, sometimes the language is actually Old Testament language. And we would do well to slow down and think about that. All right, let's go back and we're going to work our way through this chapter just looking at seven benefits of being born again. There might be more in the text, but I'm going to pull out of the text seven different things that are true if we've been born again. Let's start reading again in chapter 1, verse 3. Blessed be the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, who according to his great mercy has caused us to be born again to a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, to obtain an inheritance which is imperishable and undefiled and will not fade away, reserved in heaven for you. Now, my version says who God has caused us to be born again. That's the language of the New American Standard. Does anybody's version say something like, God has begotten us again? Is that somebody's version? Some versions say that. God has begotten us, which kind of makes the point being more about the fatherhood of God, that God has begotten us. God has caused us to be born again. That's the emphasis, not so much on my new birth, but on God being the one who begat me, who gave me this new birth. But if God's my new father, then what do I get? Did you see the first benefit there in verse 4? The promise of being born again is that we will obtain what? An inheritance. He doesn't focus on the good news of getting to start over. He focuses on the good news of what we stand to gain in the future with this inheritance of this new father. Do you think that would have been good news to first century people who maybe didn't have fathers that were worth anything? Inheritance is a great benefit in a family if a father has an inheritance to give. My dad is 83 years old. For the last 10 or 15 years of his life now, he's been talking about dying. That's just one of his favorite topics. And I don't know why you old men like to talk about that. Maybe I'll figure it out when I get there. But until recently, he lived in San Diego, California. He just moved to Minnesota. We sold his house that he bought back in the 70s for $20,000+ and just sold it for over $1 million. And I looked at my dad after he sold his house, and I was like, Dad, did you ever think you'd be a millionaire? And he's like, never thought that. But one of the things that my dad has always talked about when he talks about dying is leaving an inheritance. He didn't come from money. He never had much money. But he worked hard and wanted to be able to leave something for his kids. Now, whenever he talks about that, you know, there'll be something for you, a little bit of money left to split up between you and the kids. I always say something like, well, Dad, that's not what I care about. He says, no, but I know, but I care about it. Will that be a blessing in my life someday when Dad leaves me something? For sure. But I'll tell you what, that conversation would be way different if my dad was Elon Musk, you know? Like, I don't know if you read this, but he's projected to be the first trillionaire within the next so many years. Now, if Elon Musk is my dad and he's like, hey, there's an inheritance, I'm like, okay, when are we going to make this happen, you know, Dad? Like, you see, the idea of inheritance sort of goes up in value as your father goes up in value. But now look at what's being said. If God is your new father, you have an inheritance that is imperishable, undefiled, will not fade away. It's reserved in heaven. And everything that God has is yours. What an amazing promise that is. I don't always tell jokes in my lessons, but when I was first writing this lesson a long time ago or something like it, my then 8-year-old son, Che, he's now 21, he told me a joke that week, so it made its way into the lesson, and you guys get to hear it because I think it's funny and it will help this point be remembered. My son came up and he told this joke. He said, Dad, a little boy went to his grandfather and said, Granddad, make us sound like a frog. And the old man said, well, why do you want me to do that? And he said, please, just make us sound like a frog. And he said, well, I'll do it, boy, but you got to tell me why you're asking. And the little boy said, well, Mom said, when you croak, we get to go to Disneyland. Where my 8-year-old son heard that joke, I don't know, but it was pretty funny to me. Have some of you already received the inheritance of your parents? Your parents passed away, left you a home or left you some things, and again, it was a blessing in your life. But likely for many of you, that inheritance sprouted wings and flew away. You've already spent the money. You're not really sure where it went. But if God's your new father, again, I just want you to contemplate with me. To have an imperishable, undefiled, reserved in heaven forever inheritance from him is a blessing that's far beyond anything I can imagine. But that's just benefit number one. There's 6 more. Let's keep reading. If we've been born again, let's read verse 5 now. Who are protected by the power of God through faith for a salvation ready to be revealed in the last time. You see, if God's your new father, you don't just have his inheritance, you have his protection. In the ancient world, again, think about it. Do you think that would have been good news for some? A slave who maybe didn't have a father, a non-citizen who wasn't Roman, didn't have any legal protection. If there was someone willing to take them into their family, to become their patriarch and adopt them, give them protection, do you think, again, that umbrella of protection would have been a benefit to them? For sure. But now listen to the preaching of the first century. You can be born again and have this inheritance and have powerful protection from your father. Do you believe in that, by the way? That God protects us with his power? I think there's a lot of false teaching around this. Guys get on TV or certain preachers get up and say, yeah, if you become a Christian, God's going to put like this bubble around you and your health will be all right and your finances will be okay and he's going to keep you from harm. He's going to protect you. You know, that's not what Peter has in mind at all. Look at the next verse. In verse 6, he says, in this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you've been distressed by various trials. You see, God's powerful protection of verse 5 is not protecting us from trials. You still may get sick. You still may go through hard things. I believe the idea of God's powerful protection is he protects us through those trials, not from them. But I want you to think about it for a minute. God powerfully protects us. There's an important phrase in the verse that helps me understand it. It says, we are protected by the power of God through what? Faith. Now, I've raised 2 boys. I just mentioned my youngest is 21. My older one is 23. I would like for you to congratulate me on protecting them all their life and keeping them alive. I wasn't sure I was going to be able to do that. They're not finished yet. I understand that. They're just out of the oven, still jiggling a little bit. But like, they're good boys. They're good boys. Would you believe me if I told you the way I protected them is I locked them in a closet for 18 years and never let them out so nothing bad could happen to them? Well, of course, I was tempted to do that. But in my wisdom as a father and my power, I had to learn how to protect them, but they had to work with me some. I think I realized kind of what this verse meant when my son Cade was just a little guy. I was standing on the front porch of my house. He was playing in the front yard, and he ran down the driveway towards the street. And I looked up, and I saw a car coming. And there were cars parked on the road, and the driver couldn't see the little boy running out to the street. And from where I stood, I yelled, "Stop!" And Cade stopped right at the end of the driveway. And he looked back over his shoulder, and the car went by. He had no idea. Now, question, did I protect my son? I did. And did I protect him through my power, my wisdom, my ability to see a world that he couldn't see? Sure. But do you know what really saved that boy that day. He heard his father's voice, and he believed me, and he obeyed me. He had faith. Do you think God protects us by faith? That when God instructs us and tells us, stay away from this, don't do this, think like this, not like this, that God is in the business as a father through such direction in keeping us from harm and saving us from this terrible world that we live in. Later on in 1 Peter chapter 4, he'll say, you know, people think you're crazy because you don't go do the same things they do. You behave in a different way, but that's because you hear a different voice, and God keeps you out of all kinds of harm that they go through because he powerfully protects us by faith. Now, that's the second benefit. If you've been born again, yes, you get to start over, but you have an inheritance. You have God's powerful protection in your life. Let's keep reading. Chapter 1, verse 6. In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you've been distressed by various trials, so that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ. And though you have not seen him, you love him. And though you do not see him now, but believe in him, you greatly rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory, obtaining as the outcome of your faith the salvation of your souls. Now, if I could think of one word to describe that paragraph in regards to the fatherhood of God, I would choose the word discipline. That God knows how to discipline. Did you catch the language of going through trials, but like a goldsmith, God lets us go through the trial for our benefit, and we come out on the other side of the fire, purified and better. That's God's business in our lives. Isn't that great to know that God is that kind of father? That he knows how to, for each one of us individually, guide us through trials. By the way, none of our trials are the same. Have you noticed that? You ever looked at some other Christian's life and looked at the trials they've gone through and thought, I don't know that I could have handled that fire. And they look at you and think, I don't know if I could have handled that fire. But we've got a God who's interested, because we are his children, in bringing us through the fire for our good and for our perfection. Now, not all parents agree on how much fire to put their kids through, you know. Me and my wife weren't always on the same page with this. Now, as I tell this story, I want you to remember I didn't let my kids get hit by cars. That was too much trial, right? But I was the kind of father that would let my kids sometimes hurt themselves. Like if they were playing on something and my wife would jump up and be like, they're going to get hurt. I'd be like, let's just see what happens, you know? Because I would think they'd learn some things that way. I remember one time Cade, when he was just learning to walk, I was preaching in Los Angeles, California, and there was like a ramp out in front of the church building for wheelchairs and things like that. And this little boy was standing at the top of the ramp, looking at it like he wanted to run down it. And my wife was about to stop him, and I said, let's see what he does, you know. And so Cade stumbled a few steps down this ramp, and he fell flat on his face, didn't even put his hands down. Landed on his face, skidded down the ramp. My wife looked at me like she was going to do that to my face. And my other philosophy was pretend like nothing happened. So I was like, just, you know, I told her, don't react. And he got up with tears in his eyes and he looked at us and I was like, good job, buddy. But he had blood on his face. And he kind of wiped it and he looked at it. And he went back up to the top of the ramp. And he conquered it. He went down the ramp. And I was the greatest father in the world. I'm just kidding. But do you know what I'm talking about? That sometimes God lets us fall flat on our face, get hurt, learn lessons, goes ahead and cheers us on to keep learning in life how to do better. What a God we have as a father who promises his inheritance, who protects us, but also teaches us through the fires and trials of our life. If you've been born again, that's what you have. Now, I mentioned verses 10 through 12 is kind of a parenthetical. We've already talked about it. So skip over that. Let's go to verse 13 and continue on with this. What else do we have if God's our Father? Therefore, prepare your minds for action. Keep sober in spirit. Fix your hope completely on the grace to be brought to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ. As obedient children, do not be conformed to the former lusts which were yours in your ignorance, but like the Holy One who called you, be holy yourselves also in all your behavior, because it is written, you shall be holy, for I am holy. Do you see the language there of obedient children and father? And what's being said here? God says to us as children, you should act just like me. Be holy as I am holy. Let me be the example in your life. How many of you grew up in a family where your parents would say something like this? Do as I say, not as I do. You ever heard that before? What do you think of that? That a parent would live in a way in front of a kid and say, look, don't do what I do, do as I say. You know, I've thought about that and I think, well, maybe they're a hypocrite, but let me be fair. What else am I going to say? What else am I going to say to my kids? I've never been able to stand in front of my boys and say, everything I've ever done in my life was right. You should do it exactly as I do it. I've failed and I've messed up. But that said, some people use it as an excuse to be a hypocrite. And that's frustrating, isn't it? You know what? If God's your new father, you don't ever have to wonder about that. You've got a father now who can say, everything I've done, you do. Everything I think, you think. You be like me. I bet if I went around the room and said, hey, how many of you want to be exactly like your earthly parents? There would be very few people who would say, I want to be exactly like them. But now God, as our new father, can say to us, I'm promising you an inheritance. I'll give you my powerful protection if you'll trust me. I'll discipline you and I'll tell you, you can be just like me. Imitate me. Be holy as I am holy. What a benefit that is. Let's keep reading. Verse 17. If you address as Father the one who impartially judges according to each one's work, conduct yourself in fear during the time of your stay on earth, knowing that you were not redeemed with perishable things like silver or gold from your futile way of life inherited from your forefathers, but with precious blood as of a lamb, unblemished and spotless, the blood of Christ. For he was foreknown from the foundation of the world, but has appeared in these last times for the sake of you, who through him are believers in God, who raised him from the dead and gave him glory, so that your faith and hope are in God. A lot of great things to talk about in that paragraph, but two things that have to do with God's fatherhood. Did you catch it back there in verse 17? If we address God as a father, what do we need to remember about him? He's what? He's impartial. Did any of you grow up in a family where the parents were partial? Like they had favorites and treated kids differently? I think if you've got siblings, everybody thinks this, right? Everybody thinks, yeah, my brother or my sister got off easy. It was harder on me. Like they always, like in almost every family, it's nearly impossible for parents to live impartially. Have you ever read the Bible and seen that there's not very many good fathers in the Bible? I mean, usually it has something to do with partiality. Now, is God's impartiality, because that's the gift here, God's impartial, is that good news or bad news? Well, it probably depends on how you grew up with this impartiality, right? Because if you were the kid in your family that could always get away with murder, all you had to do is wink and smile, look at the verse again. God says, you don't get to do that with me. I love you, but you're not going to charm me out of anything. You got to treat me with respect and fear. I'm impartial. But let's say that's not the side you're on. What if you're the kid that always got the short end of the stick? That your parents never showed you any grace or kindness? That they never gave you a help or a boost, although they did it to others? Did you catch what's being said here? God's impartial. He loves you as much as he loves any of his kids. What a blessing this is. By the way, as I'm going through this, I want you to think about the richness of this, especially in the first century preaching. That if Christians were going around saying, hey, you can be born again, you can have a new father, that they wouldn't have just simply said to these people, you can start over in your life. What they would have been saying to these people is, no, do you understand the richness of having a new father, the inheritance and the protection and the discipline and the example and the impartiality? God will love you just as he's loved all of his kids. And then the next thing in that paragraph that has to do with God's fatherhood is the high-priced redemption or adoption. Peter says, God didn't spend money for you. It wasn't silver and gold that he purchased you with. Now, in the ancient world, they could do that. They could spend enough money to adopt someone into their family if you were a Roman or whatever. But God didn't spend money on you. What did it cost him to bring you into his family? The blood of his son, the blood of the lamb. I've tried to figure out how to understand this. My older brother used to tease me when I was a kid and say, you were adopted. That was what he'd tease me. Like, you were adopted into the family. That's why you're the weirdo. By the way, I need to say while I'm talking about things like adoption, I think adoption is one of the most beautiful concepts ever. That God not only adopts us into his family, but there are people nowadays that are willing to take a child, not of their own flesh and blood, but bring them into their forever family and give them all the rights and privileges and love of that family. I think that's a beautiful thing. So in no way am I talking about any of that in a negative way. But when my brother would tease me about being adopted, I wondered, what if that had been true? You know, if I grew up and dad finally said, you know, your brother's right, you were adopted. Would it matter what the story was? Like if dad said, yeah, one day there was a knock at the door. I opened the door. You were there in a cardboard box. I looked around. Nobody was around. I asked around. Nobody wanted you. So we took you in. I'd appreciate it. I would. I'd say thank you for bringing me into your family. But if my dad had said something like this, oh, actually, Andy, we heard about you. You lived across the ocean and we're in an orphanage. And we didn't know the language of that place, but we started getting lawyers and spending money, and we flew over there and met you, and we spent 3 months in that place, not really understanding what was going on, because we specifically wanted you. And by the time we were done, your adoption cost us $200,000. Do you think that would make me feel more wanted? Sure. But notice what the text says. That's not even what God did. Do you know what God did? He shed the blood of his only son for you. Do you think we should probably feel the weight of that? That if I and my own family took one of my own sons who I love very dearly to allow another son to come into my family, gave this son all the things that I was going to give this other son, do you think that kid could look me in the eye if he wasn't doing everything he could to live with the privilege and the honor that I gave him to be a part of my family? So, here's what we've got so far. If you've been born again, you have God's inheritance, his protection. You've got his discipline, you've got his example, you've got his impartiality, you've got this high-priced adoption that he's brought you into his family with. And now the seventh thing, the last thing, is in verse 22. Since you have, in obedience to the truth, purified your souls for a sincere love of the brethren, fervently love one another from the heart, for you've been born again. If you've been born again and God's your new father, what does verse 22 imply? You've got a new family. You ever met somebody that says something like this? I don't need church. I don't need the church. I don't need other Christians. Me and God, we've got a thing, me and him. He's my father. I've been born again. I don't need organized religion. You ever heard anything like that? That's someone who doesn't understand the idea of being born again. Look at verse 22 again. What they did, if their souls were indeed purified and born again, is they were put into a family, other people like this, that they were called upon, look at the verse, to love. Folks, I wish that verse said, love one another. It doesn't say that. It says, fervently love one another. I wish it stopped there. It doesn't stop there. It says sincerely and fervently love one another. I wish it stopped there. It doesn't stop there. It says sincerely and fervently love one another from the what? Heart. All right. This is a really hard question to ask out loud. Somebody's going to disagree with the question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. When did you stop doing that? When did you stop fervently and sincerely loving your brothers and sisters from the heart? And somebody will say, I never stopped. Okay, maybe you're better than me, but here's what I remember. The day that I was baptized into Jesus Christ, I loved all of God's family. I was all in and excited. And then somebody let me down, stabbed me in the back, showed their true colors, rubbed me the wrong way. And then I played this game of partiality that my father doesn't play, but I did. I fervently and sincerely loved certain Christians from the heart. They were my people. But these other ones, I just kind of loved them, you know. Do you know what will change the life of a church or the family of God? Whether locally or even larger when Christians see each other, is that we understand the concept of being born again. Guys, we're going to spend forever together with our Father and a family. And if we don't learn to fervently and sincerely love one another from the heart, then we don't really understand what it means that God's our new Father. I don't know, what do you think of that? I mean, maybe I'm making something out of the text that's not there, but I think it's there. I think there's more going on in this, but when Peter presents our salvation in terms of being born again, he lists all these amazing images and pictures of what it means. But then he ends with this Old Testament passage of Isaiah chapter 40. But before I go there, I want to show you one more thing about verse 23 that I think is important. You see in verse 23 when it says, you've been born again, not of seed which is perishable, but imperishable. That's a weird thing to say. That I've been born of seed which is not perishable, but imperishable. Why would I even think otherwise? Well, I never really caught this until a friend of mine, Roger Polanco, who preaches in Harlem, New York, he preaches in Spanish. He asked a bunch of my friends one time, I wasn't there, but he asked them, hey, what do you guys do with 1 Peter 1:23? And all the English-speaking guys said, what do you mean, what do we do with it? We just teach it. And he goes, yeah, but in Spanish, it's really awkward to teach on. Because in Spanish, the word for seed, perishable seed, is human biological seed of your father. Like, that's the word in Spanish. We miss that sometimes in the English. Do you know what Peter's actually saying in this verse? If you've been born again, you haven't been born again by your father's perishable seed, your earthly father's. Every one of us that's been born of flesh and blood, do you know what that means? It means we're perishable. It means we're going to die. But if you've been born from above, born again, you've been born with seed that's not perishable. Where did this idea come from? Isaiah 40. Let's go look at it. Isaiah chapter 40. And we'll finish the lesson in this text, but we got a few more minutes here to look at this. Now, I'm going to be in Isaiah a few times this week, so let me give you like a real simple outline of Isaiah. There's different ways to do this, but this one might be memorable. Isaiah has 66 books, or excuse me, 66 chapters. Isaiah has 66 chapters. The Bible has 66 books. Maybe you've heard this before. Your Bible that has 66 books has two divisions, the Old Testament and the New Testament. How many books are in the Old Testament? How many books in the Old? 39. 39 books of the Old Testament, 27 books in the New. Did you know Isaiah is outlined the same way? There's 39 chapters of something, and then 27 chapters of something. And chapter 40 is the pivot. It's the second half. But it even gets more interesting. Not only does Isaiah have 66 chapters, the Bible has 66 books, and the division is like basically the old and new. The themes are similar. Here's the theme of Isaiah 1 through 39. God is holy. His people have fallen short of his holiness, and because of that, there's judgment. God's holy, the people have failed, and there's judgment. That's Isaiah 1 through 39. By the way, doesn't that sound kind of like the Old Testament? God's holy, his people have failed, and there's judgment. But in Isaiah 40, there's a new theme, that God's going to send a servant and bring grace and forgiveness and healing. That's the second half of Isaiah, which is a lot like the New Testament, isn't it? A servant comes and brings forgiveness and healing to us. So I don't know what else to say about this, except Isaiah is kind of like the Bible in miniature form. That's how you can remember it. You have the Old Testament section and the New Testament section, but it gets even more interesting to me because in chapter 40, the beginning of the New Testament section, it starts just like your New Testament starts. Read it. Listen to it. Comfort, O comfort my people, says your God. Speak kindly to Jerusalem. Call out to her that her warfare is ended, that her iniquity has been removed, that she's received from the Lord's hand, has received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins. A voice is calling, clear the way for the Lord in the wilderness, make smooth in the desert a highway for our God. Let every valley be lifted up, every mountain and hill be made low. Let the rough ground become a plain and the rugged terrain a broad valley. When this New Testament section starts, it starts like this. Comfort, O comfort my people. You know why God has to say that twice? Because the first 39 chapters were really uncomfortable. And God's going to give good news to his people. I'm done dealing with you for your sins. I'm bringing good news and help to you. That's what Jesus was coming into this place. The kingdom of heaven is at hand, he would proclaim. But verse 3 is talking about somebody. Who's verse 3 talking about? Who was the voice crying in the wilderness? Remember? John the Baptist. So Isaiah 40, the New Testament section, starts just like your Bible. John the Baptist starts preaching. Well, what's he doing? Well, it says in verse 3 and 4, he's clearing a way for the Lord. He's bringing the mountains low and the valleys up, and he's making the rough ground a broad, flat surface. If you're driving home this afternoon and you look out in a field and you see some tractors out there bringing the high spots down and the low spots up and making it flat, what do you expect to see there soon? Something. A road, a highway. In the book of Isaiah, it's a highway of holiness. Or maybe a building project. In the book of Isaiah, he was going to build a tower. God was going to build a temple. You see, what John was doing was getting ready for something to be built. And I don't know everything about this, but the mountains to be brought low and the valleys to be brought up and there being like an even playing field, this might even be talking about people. That God, and in the preaching of John the Baptist, he was humbling those that were high and he was raising up those that were low, or the way that the book of James would say it, let the rich man exalt or let the poor man exalt in his exaltation, and let the rich man rejoice in his humiliation. That what Jesus does for us is he brings the high low and the low high And there's an even playing field. All right, that's John the Baptist. But now look at verse 5. Then, after the voice in the wilderness, then the glory of the Lord will be revealed, and all flesh will see it together. For the mouth of the Lord has spoken. Who's that talking about? After the voice in the wilderness, the glory of the Lord would be revealed, and all human beings, all flesh, would see the glory of the Lord. Who's that? That's Jesus Christ. John chapter 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his what? Glory. The glory of the only begotten. All right. Pretty cool, right? That Isaiah 40 starts like the New Testament starts. But now we get to the place that Peter quoted. Look at verse 6. A voice says, call out. Then he answered, what shall I call out? Okay. The way's been prepared. The glory of the Lord is revealed to all flesh. And somebody says in the vision, preach. Okay, well, what do you want me to preach? What's the good news? What's the gospel? You ready to hear it? Here's the gospel. All flesh is grass. All its loveliness is like the flower of the field. The grass withers, the flower fades when the breath of the Lord blows upon it. Surely the people are grass. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever. What? How is that good news? Let me say it a different way to you. You guys ready to hear the gospel? You're all gonna die! Every one of you! Like flowers in grass, if you've been born of perishable seed, you're all gonna die. You're gonna wither away when the breath of God blows. But you see, the good news is always preceded by the bad news. The bad news is if you've been born of flesh and blood, you're going to die. Did you catch the good news? It's at the end of verse 8, but the word of our God is forever. Remember what Peter said in 1 Peter 1? That's the word that was preached to you. That's the imperishable seed that if you'll allow that, the one who came from above, to be the one who brings you life now, you're no longer going to have to be of perishable seed like flesh or like grass and flowers. You'll have life, forever life. What a beautiful picture that is. Do you think the first century Christians understood that? That was their purpose and message to spread. By the way, that's timeless. That was as powerful in the first century as it is in the 21st century. And if the world continues on, this message will be powerful if Christians can learn that this is what we're to be preaching. And if you don't think that's what this is about, look at the next verse in Isaiah. Look at verse 9. Get yourself up on a high mountain, O church. O Zion, bearer of good news, lift up your voice mightily, O Jerusalem, bearer of good news. Lift it up, do not fear. Say to the cities of Judah, here is your God. See, the preachers of the first century, that's what they were preaching. You can be born again. You can have a new father with all the benefits of a new family and his inheritance and all the good things that come with that. Listen, if you've only ever heard that being born again means you get to start over, please hear it in a deeper way today. There's so much more that is ours if we've been born from above. We offer you that invitation. We're going to sing this song together. If we can help you in any way, let us know while we stand and sing this together.